Every day we experience hunger for food, for approval, for respect, for love, for meaningful work, for any and enough work, for home, for family, for friends, for health, for healing, for hope, for the departed, for the newly arrived, for the natural world, its prairies, trees, and rain, for drought, and for the brilliance of stars in the dark night. Every day invites us to be thankful for food, for approval, for respect, for love, for meaningful work, for any and enough work, for home, for family, for friends, for health, for healing, for hope, for the departed, for the newly arrived, for the wonder of the natural world, its prairies, trees, for the rain that ends the drought, and for brilliance of the stars in the dark night. Welcome, everyone, to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. Take a moment to greet your neighbors with a hearty hello, a warm hello. So welcome, welcome one and all. As surely as we belong to the universe, we belong to one another. We join here to transcend the isolated self, to reconnect, to know ourselves, to be at home, here on Earth, under the stars, linked with each other in our shared aspirations as Unitarian Universalists, we work for a world in which everyone has a place at the table. As surely as we belong to the universe, we know that the light that we now will kindle inspires us to help feed the hungry, to bring healing to the wounded, to bless and not to curse those who are less fortunate, to serve our progressive faith in the spirit of freedom and compassion. I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service and would like to remind everybody, if you're going to go shopping sometime this week, please consider buying a certificate from Dillon's, Hy-Vee, or Ray's Apple Market. It will benefit the fellowship. So now let us sing opening hymn number 27, I Am the Great and Fiery Force.
Thank you.
Now's the time in our order of service when we set aside to take into our hearts and minds those joys and sorrows of this community. Does anybody have a personal joy or concern they would like to share this morning?
Hi, my name is Michaela Sievers. I'm a senior at Wilmego High School, and my joy this week has been performing the Outsiders play based on the book by S.E. Hinton. And it's there at my high school. We had a show Friday and Saturday night. It was a lot of fun. I've enjoyed all the friends I've made. And I would like to share the joy with you. If anyone is interested, our last performance is Saturday at 2 p.m. So feel free to come, and it's a great show. It's a lot of fun. I'd love to see you there.
Thanks. Other joys, other or concerns? Connor?
I had a birthday party yesterday.
Was that a concern or a joy?
And my birthday is in 3 days. My real birthday.
At his age, it's still a joy.
Yeah. Happy birthday.
Good morning. I didn't ask permission to share this, but I'm going to anyway. My husband's department voted to approve him for tenure.
So. All right.
I have a joy. My name's Catherine Kreitz, and I just moved to Manhattan into a cute little house, and I'm happy to be here.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Kristen Corwin. I have a very simple joy. Logan learned to climb out of his crib, so we've switched it to a toddler bed. And I am suffering a huge sense of loss of control.
I would like to share a simple joy. A few of us from the fellowship attended the Islamic Center's open house yesterday, and it was an honor to be in the presence of all those people who come from everywhere around the globe, Bangladesh, India, Saudi Arabia, Africa, everywhere. So anyway, it was a joy. So for those joys and concerns shared, let us keep in our hearts and minds the knowledge that there are many deep sorrows and great joys that are not shared. But as you look into one another's eyes this morning, remember that.
While the choir is getting arranged, a couple of words about this morning's music. The opening hymn was by Hildegard of Bingen, a medieval saint who's just been named, and I don't know exactly what this means. There are relatively few people who have the title of Doctor of the Church, but she now is one of those. But to notice the connection to the offertory, which we'll hear in a few minutes. And I might just add that the performers of the offertory have asked that instead of applause, we have a moment of silence following their performance. a couple other music things. The anthem we're singing is one that many of you would know from your childhood, especially who grew up in more conventional churches. We are going to be singing it next February with the Congregationalists. And we will sing, for the most part, their words, the old words, in our hymnal. I think ours are better. We've made one change. You might keep an eye out for what that change might be. And finally, the closing hymn used to be called "Turn Back, O Man, Forswear Thy Foolish Ways." 20 years ago or so, some people decided that sometimes members of the other sex need to forswear their foolish ways. And so now it goes, turn back, forswear thy foolish ways, whoever you are.
Yes, yeah, sure. We'll do it after. Do that. Oh, they want to leave it here for the kids' story. And I'll do that.
Hi, is this on? I'm Kathleen Tenona, and I'd like the children to come up and help me with our children's story. I have a couple of volunteers I asked for before the service. They're going to do a little improvisational theater for you, including Dick Beeman. Yes. So if I can have my helpers that I asked earlier, if you guys could come over here. Dick, I'm going to have you right here. And then Indigo and Claire are going to be behind Dick. Jocelyn, you guys can stand back here. Okay? Leah, are you going to come help me? Come on up here. And Jocelyn. Okay, so today we're going to talk about food and where it comes from. So Dick and Clara and Indigo and Jocelyn and Leah and Kaya are in a car. They're in a big van, just like the Tenona van. And every summer, the Tenona van takes a road trip across the country, and we go to Rhode Island, and they're driving down the road. And then somebody gets really hungry. It's usually Scott. So we pull over on the side of the road, and what's there to eat out in the middle of Ohio? There's a lot of big box burger places. And sometimes we pull over, and Dad goes up and orders the Big Mac with the extra large fries. And that's kind of what we all get. So everybody's, Dick, can you pass out that food to everybody? Oh, yep. Everybody's getting it. And they're starting to eat it. And we're driving down the highway. And it kind of tastes good sometimes, doesn't it? Sometimes it tastes good. I admit it. Then, after about 30 minutes or 60 minutes or so, it doesn't taste so good anymore. I feel really full. I feel like I'm tired and I want to take a nap. No? You guys? All right, you can stop for just a second. So, hey guys, you guys, kids listening to the story, where does that food come from? That food that we stopped at the big box store, where does that come from? Ronan? Where are those cows? Do they have cows outside the door at McDonald's?
No. At the farm.
At the farm. What farm? Where is it?
I don't know. Out of the country.
Exactly. Who knows where it is? Do they have a garden there? Do they make that lettuce there for those burgers? They do? All the McDonald's have gardens?
No.
No. Who knows where that comes from, right? They're out in the country. What part of the country?
Any farm.
And farms. Where do you find the McDonald's?
No.
Babe, where do you find McDonald's?
On the road.
Where else?
Beside the road.
You find them everywhere, right? Everywhere. And they all don't have gardens, and they all don't have farms. So we really don't know where that comes from, do we? Can I take my little players? You guys make a circle for me? Now you're going to be at a Unitarian potluck. Specifically this Unitarian potluck, right? And Dick, what are you going to bring to the table? Dick's going to bring Sylvia's...
Something Sylvia.
Something Sylvia prepared. He's going to bring her asparagus. And Indigo... And Indigo's going to bring salad from Anna's garden. And Clara's going to bring a pizza that she made with sauce that we got from John Extel's tomatoes. Yep. Leah, what do you want to bring? Ask your dad. How about you bring some bread that was made from Tom and Monta's honey, sweetened from their garden? Yeah, because they have bees at their house, right?
Yeah.
And why do we know that? We know that because Tom and Monta took us on a field trip, and we went to Sylvia's garden at the community gardens, and you guys bring food here for potlucks. And a lot of times people make choices about their food, right? Oh, Kaya, she grew a lot of tomatoes this year, didn't you? Yeah, she's going to bring a tomato salad. Thanks, Ronan. Salsa, she's going to bring salsa, Ronan said. Okay. So you guys in this fellowship have made a lot of, have taught these kids this year. And when we talked about this story at home this morning, Ronan said to me, we talked about the seven principles of Unitarianism, and Ronan said, which principle? Okay, it was number three. It was number three, which is what? Acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. You guys say it a different way. That's right, Burke. What is it? What is it?
We help each other learn.
Yes. That's pretty cool. And today, you guys, we're going to talk about where your food comes from. So all those dishes that we just talked about at our Unitarian potluck, we know where they come from. They come from the soil in Kansas right around us. And they're made by people that we love, right? And that people that are helping us learn that as Unitarians, we have a respect for the interdependent web of all existence for which we are a part, right? There's a goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Those kinds of things apply to our food all the time. We have a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. That talks about our food, right? I hope it does. Acceptance of one another and encouragement of spiritual growth in our congregations. So thanks, guys. You guys learned a lot this year, and I bet you're going to learn even more later today in class. Go now in peace.
Today is our Helping Hands Sunday, and we're honoring the Flint Hills Human Rights Project. And instead of Debbie Nuss, we have Jonathan Mertz, who will share some of the reasons why we should give to that wonderful organization.
He made it. Hi, my name's Jonathan Mertz, and I'm on the board of the Flint Hills Human Rights Project. And as strange as this is going to sound, I'm going to start with the story of a Civil War soldier. Albert Cashier was a soldier for the North in the Civil War. During that time period, Albert was captured by the South. Fortunately, Albert escaped and went on to continue to serve and then lived out the rest of his life and was buried by members of his community in his uniform and with his name and his rank on his tombstone. What's kind of unique is that Albert was born Jenny Hodges, and this is in the Civil War. No one knew Albert was Jenny, and it was when Albert died that the members of his community discovered that Albert was biologically female. More on Albert here in a second. The Flint Hills Human Rights Project is our local organization to support the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender members of the community, their friends and family. We work very much with Flint Hills PFLAG, and they're a great organization too, so I'd encourage you to look them up. And many of you know our history from the last couple years. We had a rough fight 2 years ago with the city's human rights ordinance Unfortunately, we had a great victory. Unfortunately, then after the election, things didn't go our way. And so with the local political climate, there hasn't been a lot we've been able to do politically. Our main focus this last year has been on educating the community about LGBT issues and just about the LGBT community. And so hopefully some of you saw us at Purple Power Play on Points with our tent or at the Riley County Fair. And one of the first things, one of the new things we did this year is we put up posters with famous and not so famous LGBT individuals from history. And Albert was one of the featured posters that we had. Others included Leslie Gore, who many of you might remember dancing to her song, It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To. If you didn't know, she's had a partner for many years. Sally Ride, Anderson Cooper, for the younger generation, now I'm forgetting his name, a young rapper just came out this summer. That's right. And it might not seem like much, but I can't tell you how many people came up to our booth because they saw these posters and said, wow, I didn't know that. I never knew. Really? Those were probably some of the most common responses we've got. So we felt like it's been a really wonderful, successful year. Also, as part of our outreach this year, we've started a monthly column in the Hype Weekly, which if you haven't seen the Hype Weekly, it's a great weekly free paper in Manhattan, and you can check it out online, called The Gay Agenda. Again, working on outreach, developing, you know, our community, developing relationships with other members of the community. Now, that's not admittedly as exciting as getting angry at city commissioners or having a counter protest when Fred Phelps is in town, which we still do. But to be honest, our costs are just as much as they were then, and our need is just as great. And I will tell you, the second most common comment that we got, other than I had no idea, was, we're so glad you're here. New members of the community who, and actually people who said, I've lived in Manhattan my whole life, I had no idea there was an LGBT group. You know, making connections, helping people discover that they're not isolated, they're not alone. And then also from those high school kids who came up to our booth who aren't out, who saw this history and they saw their future in this history. We couldn't do this without your support. Thank you so much for it. Your congregation, your community has been vital and important to our organization and the LGBT community at large, so I can't say enough thank you for your support. And they said keep it short and sweet, so thank you.
Thank you. Morning. I'm going to talk to you about Happy Kitchen and why I have helped at Happy Kitchen and why I will do it again and why we should all consider helping there as well. I started working at Happy Kitchen a couple of years back as the scrambled eggs person, and it was a lot of fun, actually. I enjoyed being together with other people who were up early. I like to get up early. And other people who were just doing what we all felt was very important. We were feeding those who might not get food otherwise. After a year or more of being the scrambled eggs person, Elker Lorenz, who had been opening up and cleaning up the kitchen before we started in the mornings and coordinating, asked if I would help, if I would be the coordinator for Happy Kitchen. So I thought about that, and I thought, okay, well, I'll do that. It means when I get up early, I only have to go and spend 20 minutes there instead of an hour and a half or whatever I was doing before. So I went, and I did that. And for about another year and a half, I think. And then I found that my workload at work was too much, and I needed the rest on the weekend. So I needed to not get up on Saturdays, so or on Fridays so early. So Jennifer Bryan offered to help, and I was really happy that she did. And now she's the coordinator for Happy Kitchen, and I'm backup for Jennifer. And I'm really grateful to be relieved for a short time at least from the full-time coordinator job, which I may be able to take back again sometime. Manhattan has a homeless community. Though you may not have noticed them, it is natural for the homeless to keep a low profile because they feel, you know, judged. They feel the judgment of people who may consider them inferior or not want to be around them. but for whatever reason, these people have found themselves in a sad position of either having no place to live or having no job, or not having enough money to feed themselves. And I mean, it's not only the homeless and the poor who can come to Happy Kitchen breakfasts, by the way. Anyone can come. And I've often thought about the possibility of myself ending up like these people, because life, you never know what life is going to deal out. I've learned that. And for this reason, I feel really good about working, doing this kind of work. And I would encourage everyone to consider it. I don't know what else I was going to say. I was going to say it's good to get around other people that don't live the way you live. It's really eye-opening and heart-opening to see these people and meet them, and thought-provoking. And what I did say here that I think makes some sense is to get the idea that there are people who really care. It's important for these people to know that there are people that really care enough to get up early and make a meal just for them. And that could go a long way to warding off depression and feelings of hopelessness. I think that those of us who have homes and work, especially in today's economy, must not hesitate to offer some of our precious free time to those very needy people and help keep their spirits up as well as their health. And I seem to be very wordy here. Because of the times we're living in, this situation may soon grow worse, and there will probably be a greater need for more of us to get involved in serving the poor and spreading loving kindness in the community. Also, to encourage some of those who come to Free Meals to volunteer with us in preparing the meals, to give them a sense of purpose. That's a thought that I had, you know. So if you're interested in helping out with Happy Kitchen, please let Jennifer Bryan or myself know. Thank you. I think I said everything I was going to say. I'll go about this way. Okay, thank you.
gather around the table. Food is central to our lives. It shapes who we are on many levels. The gathering, the growing, the storing, preparing it, sharing it, or not, exerts a powerful force in the world. Food accompanies rites of passage, lies at the heart of holidays, and starts our day with a cup of coffee or tea or orange juice. A good meal with loved ones is something to be savored. How sad it would be if the history of food would end in famine. 60 million years ago, now just imagine, can any of you imagine what it would be like 60 million years ago? It's hard to remember 10 years ago, but go with me, 60 million years back. And there's a creature in a tree, and for some reason that creature, instead of using its mouth, extends a limb and grabs that piece of fruit, that leaf, whatever it is that helps them survive. Thus begins the long, long journey to Homo erectus, when the eyes begin to move forward and the forehead grows as the brain expands, as these creatures increasingly use their limbs to gather and to collect and to feed their young and to feed themselves. So you can see that there's a direct correlation between the evolution of our brain and the way we use our senses and hand and eye coordination with food. It goes way, way, way back to the beginning. Moving upright across the globe and using the brain has allowed us to figure out how to store vast amounts of food so that less and less people need to be a part of its preparation, its cultivation, its storage, all the stuff that makes it possible for us to have our coffee, our tea, our cereal, our yogurt, whatever it is that we have in the morning. And then when fire became something that was available to Homo erectus, and the fear of fire ebbed as they learned how to use it, cooking began. The history of cooking, putting something on the fire so that it roasts. And how often can you remember walking into a home where there's the smell of a chicken roasting, or if you don't like meat, the smell of a sweet potato getting all beautifully sweet and luscious? Those smells that invite us to open ourselves up. And it's also believed that language began with a verbalization about food. So, one of the first things you often hear a baby do, and it develops into many things. Mom, something. So it's also thought that there's a great link between the development of speech and how we expressed our desire for food. No, ick! That became a part of the process, deciding what was good for you, what felt good to you, how did it help you feel good about yourself. As civilization arose all over the world, commercial and cultural exchanges increased. The diet became increasingly complex. But for much of the people, there was still not enough to eat. This summer, Chuck and I were in New York and went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and there they had an incredible pre-Egypt display, prehistory of Egypt. So it goes back, way back, 10,000, 12,000 years ago. And in the displays of the artifacts that they gathered from that time, you could see that life started out very simple as they began to grow grains in the fertile Nile Valley. And that the difference between people and their status was relatively minimal. That people were in an effort together. But as the civilization became more and more able to collect and gather and store food, and people could use that as a way of manipulating power and structure of how things were organized, you see an increasingly complex society. There are the people who do all the work, and there are those who wear the golden crown. And you have everything in between. And not only does the structure of society become complex, the way religion evolves becomes increasingly complex. It goes along with the complexity of the culture. So if you look at the tombs of ancient Egypt, those great pyramids and those burial vaults, you will see incredible amounts of riches. But along with that, there are often hieroglyphics of triangles of bread mounded sky high. And along with that would be actual vessels for food and wine and grain, because you wanted the dead to go into the underworld or the other world with plenty to eat. And so for a year or so, people would bring food to those chambers for their loved ones. But those were for the wealthy. Those were for the people who had the means to build a burial chamber. Most people were wrapped in a white cloth and buried with no food or anything else in the desert. So here we can see how food becomes a symbol for your status in the world. And as I have told many of you over and over again, that I had lived in Sweden for 7 or 8 summers, and sometimes in the winter, I really began to explore the history of my family. And of course, at some point, you can only find so many pieces of information that are in the church records or in the township records or in the catalog somewhere. And then you end up with bones and piles of rocks. And so in the pre-Viking, the Iron Age, there were often these huge stone chambers, and they would have a circular path inside, where the wealthy would be buried with lots of food and symbols of wealth. But of course, most of my family were just simply put in the ground. And in the old Gamla Kyrka in my grandfather's town, built in 1100, there's a whole side of the grave where there are no names, but I know where my great-great-grandparents are buried, and my great-great-great-grandparents are buried, just by having been told. So we know that we cannot at some point trace our lineage back, but what we can do is find the common thread that makes us one. There was a vast disparity between the haves and have-nots in Sweden, as there was in many countries across the world and still exists today. In the 19th century, they were just leaving still serfdom. There were people who were just leaving those big estates where they were chattel, where they had to work for a piece of bread and a bowl of soup and lived in little huts. And when there was famine, many of them died. It was in the 1860s, when one part of my family moved to Kansas, and they said in a diary that in 1880 or something like that, boy, we grew the biggest carrots you've ever seen. They were 2 feet long. The parsnips were incredible. The corn, we had more corn than you could imagine. And the next year, drought. Up and down. And there was no kind of food bank which you could rely on to help those people. They had to scrape and eke out a way to survive. And I can remember my grandmother telling me that in 1905 There was a hard freeze late in May, and they had 10 acres. And her father was living in Canada. And those 10 acres were mostly devoted to potatoes. And those potatoes were the cash crop. And that year they froze. And the family had very, very little. And the oldest son migrated to America as well, leaving a mother with four young daughters. Not easy. Not easy at all. Give us this day our daily bread. Around 7 billion people in the world estimated is the population estimate. An estimated 925 million people go hungry. 13.1% of the world's population. 1 in 7 are hungry. Children are the most obvious, visible victims of undernutrition. Poorly nourished children suffer up to 160 days of illness. Poor nutrition plays a role in at least half of the 10.9 million child deaths each year, about 5 million deaths, which can be directly attributed to malnutrition. Undernutrition magnifies the effect of every disease, including measles, malaria, diarrhea, malaria, pneumonia. If you have no nutrition, it's very hard to survive these diseases. More than 16 million American children are at risk of hunger. 1 in 5 children in this country are at the risk of hunger. Households with children experience food insecurity at almost double the rate of households without children. Nearly 1 in 5 children in the U.S. is served by Feeding America, the nation's largest food bank. 5 states or districts with the highest rate of food insecure children are Arizona, Arkansas, Oregon, Texas, and Washington, D.C. The capital of this great nation has the highest, one of the highest concentrations of starving children in the country. What does that say about balance, equity, compassion? America's Second Harvest annually provides over food for 23 million people. That is more than the population of Texas. The USDA research concludes about 96 billion pounds of food available for human consumption in the United States is thrown out by restaurants, by grocery stores, by people. Food that is not bad, that could be consumed. Hungry adults miss more work and consume more health care than those who don't go hungry. Kids who experience hunger are more likely to suffer from anxiety, depression, behavior problems, and other illnesses, which reminds me of a story of a friend of mine who adopted a child, and what that child brought with him was a bag. It was a McDonald's bag. And she asked the boy, "Why, of all things, did you bring a used McDonald's bag with you?" And he didn't know how to answer, but he said, "Because it's the last time I ate." And this kid had been punished by parents for by taking food away. So at 3 o'clock, the kid would come home from school and would be shoved into a room and no food because he had done something wrong. So this happens in our own community, right here in Kansas. The cost of hunger to American society is estimated to be about $90 billion a year. In contrast, it would only cost somewhere, it's estimated, between $10 billion and $12 billion to end hunger in our nation. So we're willing to pay out $90 billion but not $10 or $12 billion to solve the problem. Why? Good question. From 2002 to 2004, 1 in 8 Kansas households experienced food insecurity. More than 1 in 3 households led by single mothers experienced food insecurity in Kansas. Food insecurity affects working families. Nearly 2/3 of food insecure households have at least one member employed full-time, but there's not enough to buy food for everybody. AARP believes no one of any age should struggle to make a choice of buying groceries, paying rent, or purchasing the medicine they need. And yet, between 2000 and 2008, the percentage of poor and nearly poor elderly with very low food security more than doubled. It went from 5% to 10%. 6 million Americans 60 and older suffer from some form of hunger. So we see it on both ends. Dramatic. More than 11,000 people in Riley County are undernourished out of a population of 73,000. That's 16% of the people that live in this county are believed to be suffering from undernourishment. These are staggering numbers, but they're just not numbers. They're our neighbors. They're our friends, perhaps. We may not know. Well, I celebrate many the victories of this last election in terms of gay rights, just great stuff happening. We know in our local Manhattan that we lost the human rights ordinance that would protect housing and job security. But on the national level, things are moving at a rapid pace, unbelievable. But still, out of the almost 2 million homeless teenagers, 40 to 60% of them are LGBT kids. And 60% of them have probably been severely bullied in school. So you put these kids who have low self-esteem and are angry, who are hurt, who are shoved out of their homes onto the streets. What do they do to get food? They sell themselves. Or they steal. There is no safe place hardly anywhere in America for these teenagers to go. It's a big problem. There are many ways that we can help, and we have helped in the past. We know that Meals on Wheels is a great way, and we can go to our food shelter, our food bank, and ask what they need and supply them with canned goods and other foodstuffs. But that's not enough. I would like to share with you a moment, an experience I had when I was volunteering for a place called Operation Breakthrough in Kansas City. Two nuns had 8 foster kids, and had started this organization in Penny's that had shut down 20 years ago, and now serve 400 mostly African-American kids. And when those kids come in, they close the doors on Friday evening, and when they open on Monday, the first order of business is to feed every single one of those children, because many of them have not eaten since they left on Friday. And when my cousin taught in Wadsworth School in the inner city of Chicago kindergarten, over 50% of those kids lived in homeless shelters. So they made sure that there was always snacks. She always made sure there was snacks on Monday morning, or else it would be just total chaos. So what can we do? Some people say we need to reduce world population, and I agree. That would be a great way to help with some of these problems. But we're not going to do it by just saying, oh, you should not have babies over there in India or in Africa or wherever people are producing at a high rate, and there's a high infant mortality rate. They first need to have a good home, they need to have food, they need to have medical care, they need to have education, and you need to target the young women because they are the ones who make the difference. They need to be lifted up so that they can have the education and the sense of self-worth that comes from it so that they can make decisions about how many children they want to have. It's not so simple to say, oh, yes, we should just decrease population. And it's so easy, as James Breach, who wrote the Silence of Jesus, who kind of tried to tease out the historical Jesus, the real Jesus, and the eight or so sayings and 12 parables that we can reasonably attribute to him in the Bible. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And in this book, James Breach says, oh, well, that's really nice when it's way far away and you can give $100 to Oxfam or to some organization that you know will do some good. You get that warm, fuzzy feeling, oh, I did something good. But he says, it's really hard to love your neighbor, the people that live next door or down the block or a half a mile away. Those people we want to avoid often, myself included. So really, on a spiritual level, on a human level, until we begin to see these people not as numbers, not as people who are just dying because they don't have enough food, but see the faces, see the hands, see the bodies, see the potential that is lost. Until we embody them, until we can see them and feel them, they're just going to remain a statistic. And I know for most of you, it's a heartbreaking reality. So we as a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship are called to do something about this. And it may mean just doing something in a very small way. It doesn't have to be a big thing. But be mindful of throwing things away. Be mindful of what you buy. How does it impact the larger cycle? Is it adding to the cycle of poverty or is it helping to decrease it? Locally grown and sold foods are one way to ensure that you are breaking that cycle. There are other ways. There is no way that I could even begin to attempt to talk about how we can do this. But I do know that it is imperative that we do take this into our hearts and find ways of helping. And Matt Campbell, who was supposed to be here today but couldn't, has a wonderful story of how he has chosen to deal with food and hunger. It's called The Joy of Brick Oven Cooking. The story behind why I built a brick oven, Matt Campbell. Whenever I show someone my brick oven for the first time, they are usually quiet. Then it comes. The question everyone asks, what was your motivation? Why did you do this? At first, this question struck me as odd. I expected questions like, how does it work? Or how did you build it? But it turns out the interest most people have is what sparked my interest enough to take on this project. I had a hard time with the answer at first, but now I realize this is precisely the question I wanted everyone to ask. What was your motivation? Why did I spend a year's time on and off working on an expensive project that made baking and cooking more difficult and painfully more time-consuming? The answer is multidimensional. The first dimension, I had a growing interest in baking bread. I began an effort to learn how to make bread that was exceptional, with complex flavors and perfect crust and crumb. Bread that was both nourishing and delicious. I eventually came across the brick oven literature. The consensus was, you can make great bread in a conventional oven, but bread that goes beyond, bread that transcends, bread that touches the soul, brings that joy to your heart, bread that nourishes not just your appetite but your spirit, is baked in a wood-fired masonry oven. The brick oven seed was planted. The second dimension, I had a growing interest in community. Although the brick oven literature focused on the technicalities of designing, building, and using brick ovens, there was often an allusion to the ties between brick ovens and communities. As it is very well known, food brings people together. Wood-fired ovens were community centers in ancient times. The smell of the fire followed by the smell of fresh bread and the promise of nourishment, who wouldn't come flocking? I wanted to build community. No better way than to host pizza parties, provide the community with bread, and open up the oven to host community baking and cooking. The brick oven idea was cultivated. The third dimension, I have always had an interest in building things, especially useful and unique things. I had never laid a brick before, but I learned. I had never heated nor used a brick oven before, but I learned. Figuring things out is just something I thoroughly enjoy. I became excited to build. The idea of a brick oven had grown into a project. There are many other attributes I associate to the brick oven: the joy and satisfaction of preparing food to nourish yourself, family, and friends, the joy and satisfaction of preparing food with basic materials, earth, stone, wood, the joy and satisfaction of carrying on traditional methods and practices, the joy and satisfaction of being connected and in touch with the preparation of food, and the joy and satisfaction of learning skills, collecting and chopping wood, baking and cooking with wood, making bread. There are many aspects I enjoy about my continuing brick oven project, but the major motivation is the combination of the three activities I enjoy: nourishing hunger, developing community, and building things. So that's one answer. What a great answer. Thank you, Matt. We have run out of time, it looks like, so let us move to our closing hymn, A Turn Back, number 120.
To
Let me share these closing words. Our fellow human beings who art everywhere, give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us for thinking small, for our mindless greed, and we forgive others for their forgetfulness. For it is our job to create heaven on earth. When we share our resources, when we break bread together, it is our glory. So we become the power that builds a better today and tomorrow. So our progressive faith calls us to do and to be. May all life be hallowed by the reach of our compassion, the blessings of our loving service. Go in peace.